Friday afternoon, 25th of May, 1973. In order to live the religious life in the true sense, it is essential to be alert and mindful. People always ask, "What do I do?" If a simple suggestion is made, and do remember, a simple suggestion may be difficult to carry out, of course, but if a simple suggestion is made, one has to be very alert and mindful in carrying it out. The sunshine seems to have evoked so much sound out of the silence. After so short a period as 2 days, you remember how the Buddha used to say, "Whatsoever the teacher can do out of compassion for all of you, that I have done for you." And you remember the words of Jesus at the Last Supper, "I go where you cannot follow." Note carefully, "where you cannot follow. But if I go not away, or rather, it is expedient that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, cannot come unto you." Consider carefully. Whatsoever can be done out of compassion for you, that have I done. Not for a moment do I wish to, and I trust I would never be so foolish as to, compare myself with the Buddha, or give any cause to make a person feel that I am playing at being the teacher, a Buddha. And I'll tell you why. It is impossible for me anyway to do that. The Buddha said the Tathagata is traceless and trackless. Siddhartha Gautama, the person, out of his compassion, as a man who had realized enlightenment, said those words to his disciples. Siddhartha Gautama is the one we know as the Buddha, unique, not to be compared. He is incomparable in the sense that he is not to be compared. It is only in our immaturity that we compare excellence with excellence. Excellence means the perfect thing. And in that transcendent state, that transcendent level, comparison just does not exist and is impossible. So that is the reason why I myself would never dream of attempting to become the Buddha or play at being the enlightened one. But Siddhartha Gautama, the man, in touch with men and women around him, out of his real, supremely human compassion, said these words. And Jesus said that if I, Jesus, do not go away, the Spirit of Truth, the Comforter, the Strength Giver, the strength which is omnipotent, because it does not impose itself. It is the absolute power. And that is, the Spirit of Truth has that. Cannot come to you. Now I've said this as a preliminary to saying that you all know that I speak quite freely. I never calculate this will perhaps offend so-and-so or hurt so-and-so, which does not mean that I'm at all interested in deliberately hurting or ticking off, as we say in common parlance, anybody. But I try to say what is the truth of the situation. The Spirit of Truth is the strength giver, the comforter. And if I can put it in as agreeable a form as is possible, I always try to do so. But I do not have any false considerateness. Just as a good doctor, a good surgeon, has no qualms about giving the medicine which he knows will heal, it may happen that this medicine, the truth, sometimes hurts. It smarts, but it is the right ointment, although it smarts. It may even, like a fire, sear the soul. But as I've said so often, the psyche is unkillable. It will sear, but it will heal. So I say what I do say in that spirit. And it is in that spirit that I made my preliminary remarks about the sunshine evoking so much sound out of the silence. When the sound intrudes upon the silence becomes dark. In other terms, the truth becomes invisible. But when the sound does not intrude upon the silence, the sound is the necessary expression of that silence. As when the perfected holy ones spoke, then that silence shines brighter than ever. Enlightenment, you see. And the enlightenment and the enlightened state is a silent thing. In the silence, creation takes place. You remember yesterday I said a few things about that transcendent feminine which holds the secret of creativeness, of creation. It is embodied in us. We are all these things. And the transcendent feminine creates in silence. Its timeless conjugation with that which by mere presence inspires it is disturbed by sound. The sound of this duality here of the psychophysical organism, not alert, not mindful, it makes the noise which intrudes. And so that transcendent feminine does not create. It just waits through time until I, the little errant child of mortality, once again am alert and mindful. Then it creates that spirit of truth which emerges out of that creation, comes right into your being as an inspiration. Something which is right beyond brain knowledge, but it works. And you, without knowing it, which is the right thing, are a light in your environment. Now, I've said a lot, really. Let us spend about a quarter of an hour just quietly meditating on it. Remember the art of meditating. Let the mind just be at peace, restful, alert, and awaiting without expecting anything, because what I expect is my predetermination and my preconception is the obstruction to true creation. So just let the mind be quiet and just remember some of the things I've said, and let those sayings release their message to you. It may not come in words or thoughts. It'll come only as a feeling. It'll be there. When the Buddha talked about the hindrances, the five hindrances, which obstruct the bhikkhu in his meditation, and which he attempts to put aside before entering into the jhanas, he mentioned perplexity as one of them. Here we spent quarter of an hour. It was almost exactly quarter of an hour. And perhaps in some minds this sort of process may have gone on. A word, a sentence may have come up, and then the thread was lost. And the mind says, what did he say about it? And one is in a state of perplexity. Or again, did he say this or did he say that? It's very easy for this sort of perplexity to arise. And then, if one gives way to that disturbance which is perplexity, it breeds another disturbance, another hindrance, worry and flurry. The mind goes floundering about like a fish which has been caught out of the sea and it's thrown on the land, and it goes floundering along. It'll die soon. Of course, that is rather a fierce simile. But this kind of thing happens. How do you tackle it? Never mind what he said. Don't worry. Pay attention to what is already there and appreciate the fact that we are unable to retain what has been put before us because our power of attention is not very strong. We cannot really attend. You know how it is said that the discourses were all repeated by Ananda after the death of the Buddha. Now, supposing that is the literal fact, what an extraordinary brain. The place where the discourse took place, the subject matter, and the whole recital of these discourses. Three great volumes of the Majjhima Nikaya, three great volumes of the long discourses, the Digha Nikaya, And what a recital that must have been! The translations occupy some 1,350 pages or so in print, and small print at that, for the Majjhima Nikaya. And the Digha Nikaya, although they are the long discourses, there are only 22 of them as compared with the 150. And there are one or two others also, something like the posthumous works of a composer. You see, the Digha Nikaya is not so long in actual print, but it occupies 3 whole volumes. And you see, that power of attention, so strong, that the impress of the teaching was present in that mind in its completeness. You see? It is also a case of sufficient interest. If the interest is really there, you remember every word. When you are really in love, and he or she says just the right things, you don't forget a single word. It's engraved on your heart, as we say. You see? We don't really care. That is the simple fact. Don't be worried or upset about it. This is how it is. Which means that it is from here that we start. And we are everlastingly here and everlastingly starting. And everlastingly mindful, therefore. Remember the Buddha's words at the end of his life. He is perpetually mindful, and he has to exercise perpetual mindfulness. The price of peace is eternal vigilance, a profound truth said, used, and understood in our world in an unhappy context. The struggle between nations and war and so on. But that is the fact. The price of peace is eternal vigilance. But there is a great difference between that spiritual vigilance and this destructive earthly vigilance. This destructive earthly vigilance is an on guard against attitude. That other vigilance is a completely open-hearted, open-minded, open-armed love. That's the difference. See what the religions mean by the love of the truth, the love of God. This everlasting alertness, this, as the Upanishads put it, the tadvanam, the love longing, which is unpossessive, which has not the slightest element of greed in it. Because if it is there, the person in whom it is there knows for an absolute certainty that this is not a thing that can be possessed, but oneself is completely and totally possessed by it. And it is like the everlasting arms underneath. You see, the truth and beauty of our real human being and human condition is beyond imagination. It is so wonderful, so divinely happy. Now,
to be basically practical, as nobody has spoken, I wonder if anyone would like to start off by putting their personal difficulties in meditation. If anybody has any difficulties, it might be helpful. We all have difficulties in meditation, either while we are in ordinary life, to keep the center point, to keep our poise. I have very great difficulty myself in the rush of daily life to keep the central poise when we are moving fast in our body and our brains are rushing madly. I wonder if anybody has a good cure for this.
I found from experience that when I do my meditation practice in the morning before going to the office, I'm trying to take this peace with me. And if situations arise in the office, mentally, it's only a second or two, I try to withdraw and then come back again to the situation. And I find this helps me very much.
You find it helpful?
Yes, very much.
May I just take you up on that? When you say you withdraw, you prefer the actual situation we're putting at the office. Could
I'm
you
trying
explain
to
that?
I'm trying to get back to this peace, which I experience.
But then that peace is separate from you when you're dealing with that situation.
No, if any situation arises which takes me away from this peace. Can you see? Do you know what I mean? Yes. If something crops up, either personalities or pressure and so on, and that's for a certain time my equilibrium is disturbed.
Yes.
Then I just, and nobody notices it, I'm just becoming all quiet within, only a second or two, and then I'll start again.
You go back to the center, in other words.
Yes, yes.
May I ask why people want to keep their poise? I want to keep their equilibrium.
Yes, that's a very good point. Mm.
It's the only point as far as I'm concerned. Why do you want to do that? Why not let go? Let it all come.
Then you lose so much energy for one thing, don't you?
Well, in office, particularly,
you can't store energy. You can't waste energy.
Yes.
I don't think you can store energy from moment to moment. I might be wrong.
But you have to get, when you lose your temper, if you lose your temper, well, I always feel you lose your holiness. You have to get back again to the point where you were before.
Why not watch yourself losing your temper?
Yeah.
If you lose your temper, lose your temper.
Lose your temper.
You'll be with the loss of temper.
I don't worry about it anymore.
Full-heartedly.
Isn't wanting to get back to the equilibrium and escape from the fact of being in a temper?
Surely, once you've seen yourself getting in a temper, it goes. You can't be in a temper and detach yourself from it.
But if you can,
I think to myself, here's Dorothy in a temper, how ridiculous.
But if you're watching yourself in that case.
You've judged it, haven't you?
You dwell on it sometimes if you get in a temper without going back into yourself, I think. Coming back into yourself gives you an inner peace again. Otherwise, you sometimes dwell on a bad temper all the morning anyway. You dwell on it longer if you don't go back or have got something to hold on to. You stay in a temper longer than you would otherwise, I think.
Don't you think Irmgard's point is that she is aware of the condition almost as it's coming?
Yes, I feel, I notice it rises up in me. I'm aware of it. And then I stop, go back to the center, and then continue.
center and find a whole enmity, I think, if you haven't got something to go back into. Do you want to comment?
But what is it that you're trying to do? What is the aim? What is the end point?
Cut it off, as it were. Cut it.
You're trying to stop it.
Like yes, cutting it away.
Isn't it that you want to live harmlessly? Because usually when we lose our temper, we don't hurt only the other people concerned, but ourselves as well.
Well, if you're inclined to be a bit genteel, I think you hurt yourself more than the other people.
Yes, quite.
Often. And that's why you, as a person, if you're a bit genteel, you reflect more than the other person, or the other person lets it go off like a wart on a duck's back, but unless you've got something to go back into, you don't. Unless you can cut it off. Like putting down a telephone receiver.
But this all comes down to mindfulness, doesn't it, in all conditions and of life. This awareness of what is happening within us, what we're thinking, everything. And we can surely be aware that we are in a temper. or if we can catch it, I always feel that we could catch it rising up.
Yes, but how often is that the answer? And how often is that only in the mind, as it were, this feeling that if we can catch it, then it stops? The times we do catch it and we do look at it, it doesn't stop. It seems that one has to really persevere with this. I think we expect magic if we think that just because temper comes, we look at it, it disappears. I don't believe, personally speaking, that this always happens. Not by
of course not. Of course.
I mean,
one
has to go on watching temper after temper after temper, or what have you, before you.
Of course. Really. Yes. All, not only temper, but
yes,
everything
whatever,
else.
What happens? But I mean, it isn't. It all sounds rather magical when you sort of say we just watch it off it goes, you know.
And you raised the point the other night, I think, about an occasion when you lost your temper, and am I right in saying you were all the better for it, and so was the other person?
Well, I don't think I was the better for it, but the other person was, most decidedly.
This can happen, doesn't it?
I did, on that occasion, definitely lose my temper. But it was the right thing in that circumstance. I didn't do it deliberately, but as it turned out, it was the right thing for that person.
You mean it was a stimulus to an action which you probably wouldn't have taken otherwise?
Which the other person might not have taken otherwise.
It seems to me that this is a case of where temper, and because you've taken this quality of temper, which in itself has no substance. What is temper? Could you put it on the table and examine it, for instance, say, ah, that's a bit of temper. It seems to me that the as I see it, the basic thing is that you are not separate from that temper.
That's what I was thinking.
You are all of these things, all these emotions which simply have been labelled temper or hate or jealousy or love, if you like, kindness, whatever it is. Surely this constitutes you. This is the entire person. So why? You have to deal with everything, do you not?
Isn't it the real you that's just peeked out quickly?
Well, what's the difference between the real and the unreal? I mean, there is you.
This is what you're trying to prevent. You're trying to stop it down, but it comes out in spite of yourself.
No, I think that's divisive. I don't think that. I think one has to get to grips with the fact that you are all these things, the 10,000 things the Chinese talk about, but not a suppressed you here and a higher you there and a something other you somewhere else. This is just
another part of you. Because you're trying to suppress it, comes out.
Actually, things like temper that come out don't worry me nearly so much as fear. Now, fear's the thing that does me. I arrive at a situation, perhaps one of my children's flying or something of that sort, and I can't get rid of it. if I can see a temper and it goes, but this fear thing is upsets me and I can't shift it.
But you're projecting, you are fearful at that moment, but you're fearful of something that might happen.
I know. And I know, I mean, this is the awful part, and you can't get rid of it.
I think we all have that experience.
But it's a much worse experience for me, I don't know about anybody else, than any other emotion.
Surely we all have it.
I thought, yes, we all have it. I'm sure.
It's a very basic thing in everything.
But this is the thing that if we're talking about this sort of thing that, you know, that you want to shift, is the basic thing that I would have thought probably affects everybody more than any other thing.
Why do you want to shift it?
Well,
you want to shift yourself.
Just move away the pain and keep everything pleasant.
Could we perhaps use the word understand rather than try to shift or move? Is it not a question of understanding? I mean, fear is the greatest factor in all our lives, and I suppose it's the number one thing really that we should all try and understand. Because, again, it is not something that is outside of ourselves, is it?
No.
It's in relation to time and to a great number of other factors, all of which we are conscious of. I mean, take the original statement about the temper. You fear the temper rising, or even worse still, you fear the guilt you're going to have after the temper, or you fear you won't suppress it in time. I mean, this is all again in the world of duality, isn't it? It's in, always in relation to something else.
Yes. I think when these emotions rise in us, fear, anger, or even hate, one in fact does lose energy.
Squandering energy is enormous because all the images come up. Your fear, for instance, of seeing this aeroplane smash or whatever it is, all your energy is going in that. You are creating more forms and more forms and more forms, and all your senses are alerted, aren't they? You can see it all in you, and you're absolutely agitated until you've got a cable or a telephone call or whatever it is, and in the end you sort of, oh, I'm utterly exhausted, and the man's arrived home quite safe and sound, and it's never happened
to me. Well, why? Yes. Not being able to restore energy. I think in meditation that one is restored, and in that there's this fullness, which, if we experience these perhaps illusions of anger, fear, and hate, one has this inner strength to give a part of ourselves which isn't experiencing this. It's making us able to.
Who is the you that keeps that separate?
Yes, what's the part?
It isn't for me. It's the part you were talking about when you observed in the office that you were perhaps being drawn into this.
Yes, like seeing a play on the stage, and you know, you're standing away from yourself, so to speak.
Still part of yourself.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
It's observing.
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 Observing. As it were.
Are you different from what you have observed?
Are you different from what you're observing?
In fact, what we don't know, what we created to be a different thing on So it's a question of attention, isn't it? It's not the fact of fear that we're in contact with. We have the idea of fear. We're never directly in contact with the fear itself. We're always trying to escape from it. Mm. This surely is why it's always with us.
You mean you're probably fist here? Not any particular
cause. The idea of fear. But it's because we never actually experienced the fact of fear itself.
Surely, when a situation of acute danger arises, one is afraid of that situation, or what one knows it will probably result in. This is a sort of biological safeguard, isn't it?
Yes.
And that is fear of a thing, and not fear of fear. Fear of being prayed.
This is something different from the sort of psychological fear we're talking about now.
I understood you to mean that there is nothing wrong with this thing.
So you're making the distinction between the psychological fear and physical, as Krishnamurti does. If you see a precipice, you obviously take action. You don't fall into it, or you get out of the path of the snake or the wire.
The general flows then, and there's some action which takes you out of the danger. That's common sense, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the kind of fear we're talking about now.
The trouble is too that we hang things, our fear onto things. We don't see fear as fear. But we become fearful of something, and that we could be afraid of this or that, thousands of things, but we never really study the thing in ourselves which is fear. I sometimes feel that if one could really come to terms with that, then you see how different everything else would be, because you'd no longer be afraid of small rooms or crossing the road or this. You would have dealt basically with the thing itself without hanging other things onto it.
You'd wait till it came like.
You see, I mean, we get involved in a particular fear. I am
before
so terrified of Chinese or something, or of going across the road. We push our fear onto that thing, but what we don't study is fear.
Is it a question of studying?
Well, you use these words.
It seems to me that sometimes when one is in that sort of position, if one just gets on with the job in the now, then that fear automatically goes.
Yeah, but it can be very overwhelming, dear.
Yes, but well then, but you stick to your guns and you sort of... you go on cleaning the house or doing whatever chore it is, or going out and buying your food for the day or something. You just concentrate on that, and the fear cannot come in.
Yes, but you're excluding it, Dick. The whole point of this, as I understand it, is that one should understand what this thing that is labelled fear is all about. After all, this silence that we have been asked to understand in this summer school, and our very first experience of it at the table, we all said how some of us felt we had to say something, others were frightened they wouldn't get enough, or somebody was, or we were embarrassed, we were this, that, and the other thing. Now, all these so-called labels are in relation, really basically, to the fact that we were frightened of this silence. It was something unknown to the majority of us, because we live in a world of noise and chatter, and there we were being taken out of the familiar and placed into something which was quite unfamiliar. So we all reacted, and I think if we're absolutely honest with ourselves, we did this because we were frightened. We didn't know what was up. What was going to happen? We may displease Feroz, and we may discover something awful about ourselves. We may even find something very nice about somebody we disliked intensely. All sorts of things happened to us because we were quiet.
Because the fact is, we did observe all that, and we can't be that which we observed.
Say that again, I'm awfully sorry, but didn't get there to talk.
If you're repeating what happened in one's mind at a meal time.
Well, I'm only suggesting what happened in the
number of minds. Yes. We observe that. We cannot be what we observe.
Oh, but we are it. I mean, the mere fact. Yes, we are that.
The observe and observe become one, isn't it?
Otherwise, Ruth, the transformation, look, we all felt, and we each of us said at various times, at some time, if we didn't say it all together, at some time we said, wasn't it wonderful? Wasn't it lovely? I felt so peaceful. Wasn't it happy? Now, we couldn't have had that emotional impact, that couldn't have taken place, if the unpleasant things which upset us so were not transformed.
Yes, I see that, but I do feel that is a sort of game. A game, yes. A play. And that one could, in fact, as you do at the office sometimes, step out of it.
Should we rather ask the question, for whom are we afraid?
Yes.
For whom are we afraid?
No. And I think really, of all things, the fear you're talking about, in your pandemic, it's in the mind. Whereas there is that fear which comes from the outside, which is like falling over crisps, getting run over. There's that actual thing of the now. And there's the fear which is not of the now, which is, I think, much greater, because it's from the imagination.
It's all two ways to energy, the fear of fun.
Yes, but it's there, in that...
Tomorrow, next year.
Tomorrow, the fear that you're impotent to do anything about, unless you really examine it. Will the plane arrive safely?
We're going to die, in other words. The fear of death, basically, isn't it?
Yes, these fears which are... put into a mythical future.
Fear of coming to an end.
Yes, we can get on, you were saying, in the here and now, we can get on with our work.
Mm.
And but the fear in the mind, I think, is more terrible than anything.
Well, surely here is where Thoreau has always been so helpful to us in pointing out to us that we are a psychophysical organism, and to remember that we have this animal inheritance. And there is this relationship that we have to try to understand between the physical fear and the psychological fear. The fact that man is the only creature who has this ability to think and use this brain of his. Now, the relationship between this is a very tricky thing. And we are pulled surely constantly between the physical urges and the psychological urges. And the psychological urges are the things that we produce, as it were, in our mind, the images that we form. We form tens and thousands of images. And they all become alive. They're real to us because we keep them alive with our energy. But they disintegrate and fall apart. The minute we have sufficient insight, if you like, and courage to sit and really look at them. It sounded a facetious remark, but it isn't. Take
when you look at them, they dissolve.
Right.
That's now what I'm trying to say. That it's not this and it's not this. We are being able to observe that, and in that observing, dissolve. When you see something, you're not it.
Well, it's transformed, isn't it, rather than...
No,
yes, if you like.
It's dissolved, really, because you can stand back and look at it. And, as you say, withdraw.
I think it's always this passing question for some of us, where we learn that we must observe what's going on in our mind. We also learn that the observed and the observer are one. And sometimes this becomes a confusion, because to try and see ourselves as a whole and at the same time to see ourselves standing back and observing ourselves is a little too much. And I think sometimes this is where a bit of trouble, and we may all be talking about the same thing, but the division is here. There isn't a real division, but this is how we feel it.
We are the duality.
The difference, yes. Trying to be one and trying to observe ourselves, which makes us into two.
Yes.